One of Illinois' biggest film festivals is back this week, and today, Chaz Ebert joins us to talk about the lineup moviegoers can expect during this year's Ebert Fest. Plus, David McCraw is one of the chief lawyers for the New York Times, and the Central Illinois native has a new book out called Truth in Our Times, Inside the Fight for Press Freedom in an Age of Alternative Facts.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks to Brian Moline for filling in for me a little bit last week. Coming up this hour, we're talking to the New York Times Deputy General Counsel David McCraw. He's an Illinois native of Monticello, actually, who's back home. You might remember him for his now famous letter he sent President Trump's lawyers a few years ago. We'll be talking about his new book, Truth in Our Times. But first, let's go to the movies.
We are gathered here to celebrate love, pure and simple. Rachel is pure, Sydney is simple.
A television program for children made its unauspicious debut on station WQED in Pittsburgh. Its host, Fred Rogers.
Mr. Rogers?
Yeah.
I want to tell you something.
What would you like to tell
me? I like you.
I like you, my dear. Thank you very much for telling me that.
Dwa serduszka, cztery oczy. Oj, oj, oj. Co płakały we dnie w nocy. Oj, oj, oj.
Now the young lady that we've all been waiting to hear. She can sing anything. Anything. My sister, Miss Aretha Franklin.
Just four of the 12 films that will be featured at this year's Ebert Fest. That was Rachel, Getting Married, Won't You Be My Neighbor, Cold War, and Amazing Grace. Ebert Fest starts Wednesday at the Virginia Theater in Champaign. This is the 21st year of the iconic film festival that brings Hollywood stars to Central Illinois. The CEO of Ebert Companies and Ebert Festival producer, Chaz Ebert, is on the line now from Chicago. Hi, Chaz. It's great to welcome you back to the 21st for the 21st Ebert Fest.
Hi, Nyla, and I am sitting here. Those notes that Aretha Franklin hits in Amazing Grace make me cry each time. It is so, her voice, so pure, so beautiful, so soulful, and when she sings Amazing Grace, it just, it really affects me.
Oh, wow. I think it affects everyone when we're listening. It was hard for me. I actually cut that audio and I didn't want to cut the song off. We were joking. We were just like, we should just play this whole thing. And then that could be the whole. But maybe can you tell us a little bit about this film? So this is 2 days of a Baptist church film condensed to 90 minutes?
Yes. Well, what happened in 1972, the director Sidney Pollack, was going to shoot Aretha Franklin singing gospel. If you remember, at the time, Aretha was like so popular, but some of her church people, because she came out of her father's church in Detroit, some of the church people felt she was losing her church roots, and she really wasn't, but she was so popular in the secular world that she decided to go back to a church and record a gospel record. Sidney Pollack directed it. It turned out to be, as a record, the most highest selling record in gospel history. The film, however, Sidney Pollack was starting out, and his sound men and cameramen didn't have the video and the sound synced. So they couldn't do anything. They couldn't use it. They couldn't show it as a film. Years later, a producer and someone who was in the record business named Alan Elliott heard about this amazing footage that was in the vault, and he asked to see it, and he made it his mission. He became obsessed with getting it out to the public, and it took him 11 years to do it, but he finally did it.
That's Amazing Grace, and there are so many wonderful films in this festival. Can you remind us again how these get selected and who this year's festival is especially honoring?
Okay, yes. The films are all, this is a curated festival, so we don't accept outside submissions. It was originally curated by Roger and me and Nate Cohen, who was our festival director. After Roger passed away, Nate and I curated the film festival together. We do the selections. And we try to use, whenever we can, films from a list that Roger and I had talked about before he passed away. You know, each year we would talk about movies, and he would talk about movies with Nate. But Nate and I also continue to go around the festivals, and we choose films that we see that we think would be good for the festival. Even if Roger hasn't seen them. But as much as possible, we would still like to have Roger's stamp on the festival.
And so this festival also this year honors a couple of people, including the late actor Scott Wilson, Jazz?
Oh, Scott Wilson. Not only was he a fabulous director, you know, in The Heat of the Night, In Cold Blood, Monster.
Chaz, you know, I have to tell you,
Dead.
Yeah, I know him from The Walking Dead. As Herschel. And I feel like that was my introduction to Scott Wilson. But obviously, he has this entire film career.
Oh, my goodness. If if one of the things this film festival does, and this is one of the things that we like to do, is introduce today's audiences, to someone body of work they should go back to look at. And those people who know Scott Wilson only as Herschel will have a heck of a time going back and watching some of his other roles. So Scott Wilson was a great friend of the festival. He was also a personal friend to me and Roger. And when he passed away last year, you know, we were all so sad. We said we have to dedicate the festival to his memory. We're going to show a film called The Year of the Quiet Son that was shot in Poland, and it's one of his best roles.
I wanted to ask you about another film that you said was very personal for you and Roger, and that's Rachel Getting Married.
Oh, my goodness. Rachel Getting Married. First of all, Jonathan Demme is another person who was a friend because our values aligned so well together. To me, Roger and Jonathan Demme were two of the kindest men that I knew, and they both cared so much about making the world better. When they got together, they talked about movies, of course, but they mainly talked about things you can do to help other people. And so when Roger and I saw the movie Rachel Getting Married, first of all, we loved it just for its cinematic value. But underneath, we kept digging and digging. What is it about that movie that makes us love it so much? You know, we said we could live in that scene it's about a wedding, and Anne Hathaway plays someone who just got out of rehab, and her sister's getting married. So that's the premise of the movie. But so much happens in there just watching family members come and go and friends come and go and watching the conflict and watching people forgive each other and love each other and stick up for each other, even when they're angry with each other. It just teaches you so much about life, but about how life would be if it were, you know, it was like Jonathan Demme said, it was like a mini utopia. And the last time I saw Jonathan Demme, I was explaining, it was after Roger passed away, and he had actually come to see Life Itself in New York, the movie about Roger. And I told him, when I told him how much Roger loved that movie, he wept. To him, he said, Roger got it. Roger got just what he was trying to do with that movie. He said, some people look at it as just a movie, but no, it's so much more. He put so much of himself and so much of his values in that movie.
And values of empathy, Chaz. And I know that this year I wanted to ask you, a lot of the Ebert Fest is about empathy and how films can help us empathize with each other. And the Humanitarian Award this year is going to be given to Morgan Neville for the Fred Rogers documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor?
Absolutely, about Mr. Rogers. That's another thing. You know, I just wish that Roger could be here for that particular award, because he would be just rooting for Morgan Neville, who, oddly enough, and unfortunately, the Academy Award did not honor him for that film. Everybody just thought it would be a front runner in the documentary category, but it didn't get nominated for an Oscar. But we're going to honor it with the Ebert Humanitarian Award. And, you know, one thing that I love that Morgan Neville says about Mr. Rogers, he said, Mr. Rogers believed in radical kindness. Radical kindness. I mean, just think of those terms together.
Yeah, what does that mean to you?
Oh, my goodness. For me, radical kindness means just the things that we're talking about, what I call the Ebert effect, where we talk about empathy and kindness and compassion and forgiveness, all of those things bundled up into one. All of the things that we don't see, frankly, from our leader in the White House right now, I really think that it's something, radical kindness are random acts of kindness, doing something for someone just because, or, you know, forgiving someone. You know, we had a day for empathy in Chicago last year, and we're only going to have it partially this year, but we talked about things like smiling at someone, giving them the parking space, you know, letting it go, enjoying people, and just things, radical kindness. When you want to do something, you have compassion for someone in your heart, and you want to make life better for that person, for the next person. What kind of things can you do to help? And it could be a lot of different things.
Jess, I wanted to also ask you about this whole idea of empathy and the fact that you all are doing something different this year with Ebert Fest, which is bringing a VR demonstration to Ebert Fest to give audiences a chance to experience empathy through technology. How's that going to work?
Yes, we are. Because with virtual reality and with some of the things that they do with these 360 cameras and the angles, they actually try to pull you as the person into the experience of someone else, so that you're not just looking, you know, in our 2D reality. We are looking at the screen and we are identifying with what we see on the screen, but in the virtual reality, you become the person. You are the one having that experience. So whether you are someone who's involved in a conflict war zone, or whether you're someone in another country, but seeing the joy and celebration of someone having a life-affirming experience, it does something so that viscerally you get to feel what it's like to be in that situation. So we decided to try that this year because technology is also something that we value. The other person that we are honoring this year is Richard Roper, who was Roger's TV partner for like the last 8 years.
Chicago Sun-Times film critic. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Oh, no, yes, I was. And so Richard Roper, we're going to have clips and a tribute, and we're going to put him on the hot seat and ask him some questions that he may find embarrassing.
You're going to be asking him those questions, right?
I will be asking the questions, and we'll have some other people in the tribute as well. But I will take the lead because we've never done this before. You know who's going to be here?
Who's that?
Gina Gershon and Jennifer Tilly with the movie Bound that was made by the Wachowskis. And
so everyone is famous for knowing them about The Matrix. This is actually the first film that they did.
Yes. And so I am just really thrilled that we're going to have that we're going to have them here representing the movie.
When we think about all of these films, Chaz, I just wanted to ask you about how much you think these films speak to, I mean, some of these are very old, some of these are very new. How much you think they speak to what we need to hear now in 2019?
I think that, you know, especially Mr. Rogers, Cane River, you know, that's a movie that was made some 40 years ago, but and it's being restored. We have a movie about Maya Angelou, really just about all, even Romeo and Michelle. Even it's going to be a crazy, funny movie. But the thing that you see in all of these movies are something that deals with empathy and kindness and compassion and forgiveness. I think that those values are some of the things that keep people coming back to Ebert Fest, because we have it on the screen and we want them, when people come out of the theater, we're hoping that they feel changed in some way and that they're able to go out into the world and, you know, and face it better and be kinder and be more compassionate and smile.
The 21st Ebert Fest begins on Wednesday, goes through Saturday, April 13th. Chaz Ebert has been talking to us about it all and giving us a little preview. Chaz, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
Oh, Nyla, always a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you.
Support comes from Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting the School of Art and Design Master of Fine Arts Exhibition, on view April 13th through 25th, with an opening night reception at 5 p.m. this Saturday. More information at kam.illinois.edu.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Bad things are happening to our democracy and we need to do something. Well, I don't think you can state it plainer than that. That's one of the lines in a new book by New York Times Deputy General Counsel David McCraw. It's called Truth in Our Times, Inside the Fight for Press Freedom in an Age of Alternative Facts. David is the lawyer whose letter to President Trump went viral in a big way a few years ago. To be clear, the letter was actually to President Trump's lawyers, who wanted the Times to retract a story that featured two women who accused the president of touching them inappropriately years ago. David is an Illinois native. He's from Monticello. He's also a U of I College of Media grad, which is why he's back in Central Illinois and in studio with me in Urbana now. Hi, David. Welcome back to Illinois.
Thank you very much and glad to be here.
So I have a lot of friends who are lawyers, and a lot of them started out wanting to be journalists. That was also the case with you.
Yeah, I graduated from the journalism school here, and I worked at the Quad City Times in Davenport, Iowa. And I had a completely undistinguished career in journalism. Nobody cried the day I left journalism. I think I'm actually perfectly placed to actually do some good for journalism now.
And as a journalist myself, I can remember the first time I had to deal with a newsroom lawyer. And it was when I was at the Miami Herald, and I got a call saying from a lawyer saying that I was going to be subpoenaed. And I remember being terrified. It was a union, and they were threatening me about a story I had written saying they wanted something. And I went straight into my editor's office, and she said, call the Herald's lawyer. And I talked to Robert Beatty, and it was one of those things where he just said, you're going to be okay. Everything's going to be fine. I'm going to handle it. Is that how most of your conversations go with reporters?
I do think it's important to help everybody understand that the First Amendment gives really broad protection in this country, and that I find it very, very disturbing when lawyers for the press create fear. They are really working at cross purposes with the First Amendment is about. What Justice Brennan said in Times versus Sullivan was, we want the media to be free to pursue hard stories, to pursue hard truth, and we're not going to allow the law to be one of the things that prevents him from doing so. So, yeah, I try to be reassuring. There are times when something's happened where reassurance may not be the first thing that I can get to. But in the end, it works out more often than not.
And you mentioned the New York Times versus Sullivan. I mean, when we think about the First Amendment, I think a lot of people think of the broad protections that applies to the freedom of the press. But then there are sort of these key legal cases that establish that. Can you tell us about the New York Times versus Sullivan, that case?
Sure.
It's really 64?
In 1964, exactly right. Incredibly powerful case, and decided over an advertisement. It wasn't decided over journalism, but its effect has been on actual news coverage. The justice of the Supreme Court recognized that libel suits were being used by powerful people in the South to try to keep the Northern press from coming down to Alabama and Mississippi and Georgia and telling the truth about what was going on there, about the violations of people's civil rights, about the oppression of people of color, and the destruction of voting rights. And they said it had to stop, that they were not going to allow libel suits to be misused. You know, a libel suit is supposed to be about the protection of reputation, but they got it. They got that they were actually being used to stop important information from reaching the American public.
And so this went all the way to the Supreme Court?
It did. The Times lost in Alabama, not surprisingly. A $500,000 verdict against the Times brought by a police commissioner named L.B. Sullivan. And he wasn't even mentioned in the ad that was the subject of the litigation. The ad had been placed by supporters of Martin Luther King and talked about the deplorable situation in Montgomery where students who were protesting for civil rights were essentially victimized by the police. Sullivan argued that because it was about the police, people thought it was about him and his reputation was hurt. Completely preposterous theory. There were 25 copies of the New York Times that went into Montgomery County in Alabama. And I can assure you that nobody who thought highly of Mr. Sullivan thought less of him because of a civil rights ad in the New York Times.
I wonder how you think the current Supreme Court would rule if a case like that came before them today.
Really interesting question, because as you know, Clarence Thomas a couple weeks ago issued a concurrence in which he said the Times versus Sullivan was wrong, that it was improperly decided and the court should revisit it. And people started asking me whether that concerned me. Somebody actually said, you should mark your book off of that. You know, read this book, find out why Clarence Thomas was wrong. And I said, well, that would be really great, except I would have to include a magic marker with every copy, because I say in the book the law is not going to change and we'd have to be crossing that out. But I think this Supreme Court has been a stalwart of the First Amendment. They haven't taken a lot of media cases, but they've taken a lot of cases that involve other kinds of speech. And the conservatives tend to be libertarians. They think that the First Amendment means pretty much what it said, that there shouldn't be a law abridging the rights of the press. And I'm confident that despite Clarence Thomas's concurrence, that it's likely to stand up. The current state of the law, that is. And, you know, it's one of those things where when I have conversations with serious people, left, right, center, doesn't matter, nobody ever says to me, you know what we need more of? We need more libel suits where rich people can make a whole lot of money by suing newspapers. That's just not one of our great national problems. I think most people understand that most libel suits are not really about the protection of reputation. They're about trying to silence somebody.
My guest is David McCraw, and that book he was talking about is called Truth in Our Times, Inside the Fight for Press Freedom in an Age of Alternative Facts. And that brings us to our current president. And when we think about that, you actually had a lot of experience with President Trump's lawyers before he became president. In fact, in your book, you write about this. You call it the Great Trump Lawyer Machine.
That's right. When Mr. Trump was a real estate developer in New York and a celebrity on The Apprentice, he was having his lawyers contact the Times with some frequency.
So much so that you actually created like a boilerplate response that you just sent them?
There's one that I would code through, and I'd have to change the date on it, though. But it inevitably was about a single topic, and that was, how much was Donald Trump actually worth? And the Times had done a series of stories over time that had raised questions about his representations of his wealth. And his lawyers would jump in after each of those or while we were working on it, and we would have these incredible discussions of how you actually calculate worth and so forth and so on. But the great legal tip I got from one of his lawyers was I could rest assured that we would never get a complaint about anything we said about his hair. The hair was fair game. His wealth, different matter.
that's an interesting tidbit. And when you think about that, and I guess this is the whole idea of how many times libel suits, I think if you were a journalist, you are used to the idea that you will be threatened with a lawsuit for libel.
Right.
But how many times does it actually happen? I wonder how many times do you, as Deputy General Counsel of the New York Times, have people call and threaten versus actually bringing forth a lawsuit?
The pile of threats is very, very high. The pile of lawsuits is very, very short. Over a 10-year period, we had 16 lawsuits in the United States. When you consider that the New York Times puts out 200 pieces of content a day, audio, video, print, that's an incredible record. And I think it's a testament to how strong the law is here. It's also a testament to how we at the Times approach libel suits, and that is we do not settle libel suits in the United States for money. Makes my job easy because we're never going to be negotiating over, hey, you know, here's $5,000, go away. We're not going to do that. But the threats obviously still come. The threats come from around the world because
right,
we're global.
Right, because, like, for example, in the UK, this was something I learned when I worked in the UK. I didn't really – truth is not a defense for libel if you are a British journalist.
Well, it is a defense. It's just that you have to prove it. In the United States, the plaintiff has to come in and prove the story's false. And that is a real flip of the switch. The one place, though, that you may be thinking about is that privacy suits are something that's very common, and truth is not a defense there.
Sorry, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So England, embarrassed by what Americans were saying about their libel law, actually has changed it now. And we still get threatening letters from English lawyers who, I guess, assume we don't know that they've changed the law.
You also do, for better or for worse, you handle a lot of security issues for the New York Times. A couple of weeks ago, Joel Simon was actually on the program talking about his work when it comes to reporters who have been kidnapped. There's a scene you describe, which is the newsroom of the New York Times after the 2016 election. Reporters being very concerned. The site 8chan is releasing their home addresses. People are getting very threatening, anti-Semitic literature sent to their home addresses. As someone who defends the First Amendment and the right to free speech, how does that work when you're in a newsroom and people are talking about people sending threatening letters?
And you're right. It's one of the things that has really been a turn for the worst. And it's a turn for the worst for the American people, because it is an attempt to silence and it is an attempt to keep people from reporting on hard stories. I applaud our journalists. They have shown a great deal of resilience. They have continued to do their job despite the threats. But nobody got into journalism thinking that they were going to have to risk their life, at least not in covering Charlottesville, New York, Chicago, that covering U.S. politics shouldn't be a death match. Now, most of the threats we get are not really ever going to turn into anything. They are small people, scared people sitting at home alone who think that they can act with impunity, write whatever they want, scare people. But they don't tell us that. They don't begin by saying, I'm a small person who is a threat to no one, and I'm going to feel like a real man by threatening somebody and her family. So we have to take them seriously. We have barricades outside our offices, stop car bombs. We have a 24/7 hotline that reporters can call when they get threats. We investigate the threats. We've had to go with the police several times with some of the threats. At the end of the day, it's important that we do everything we can because to make sure that our journalists are safe. They do hard work. It's hard without the threats. Threats shouldn't be part of the environment.
And I think threats have always been a part of a journalist's life, but I think that you would agree that something has changed very much in the past few years.
I think a couple things have happened.
And I'm talking even before the Capitol Gazette shooting.
That's right. And the Capitol Gazette shooting was certainly a reminder of just how dangerous things can be. Yes, threats go back a long ways. In my time at the Times, they would come up from time to time. I think that there is a certain amount of there's been a rise in the threats, in part because of social media. More people are online. More people are letting loose with their opinions. I think that they are encouraged by certain groups that suggest that that's perfectly okay to do that. And it's an expression of a lot of anger that's out there. One of the things that I find fascinating about this is that there was a threat a few months ago. Somebody writes this threatening email, and he's so captivated by his own voice being Mr. Threatener that he forgets that his name and address is at the bottom of the email. So that meant within a few minutes, I knew where he worked, and I emailed him at work, telling him I need to have a conversation. I received an incredibly unclever email about how sorry he was. But it was as if he felt here was a guy who was just a guy who goes to work, average office worker, who at night felt that, you know, threatening somebody at the New York Times was, I guess, like watching TV.
Well, and I do think there is sort of an interesting element of removal when we think about interactions. Like, I think about interactions I get with our audience. I often sometimes wonder, would you say this to someone in person? But there is sort of an element of when you're writing an email, there's kind of this removal where people have sort of a strange freedom to express themselves in a way that maybe to them it's not even doesn't seem that real because
that's correct.
It's not in person.
You're a character on the radio. I'm a character in the newspaper. I'm a character on TV. Yeah, so there is that kind of removal. But I think it really underscores a point that I try to make in the book, which is that I'm not that concerned about the law changing, but I am concerned about what I call the hearts and minds problem, that the attacks on the press for being the press are really poisonous. And when people are saying enemy of the people, fake news, stain on society,
the president's saying that.
And when the president's saying that, especially, it has essentially the same effect as controlling the press, because if the press is simply disregarded, disbelieved, then the press cannot be the check on government that it needs to be.
And do you think that's the point?
I think that's exactly the point. I don't like the fact that the Times, our publisher, I myself get teed up as the opposition to President Trump. That's not where we want to be. We want to be like any news organization, hard on people in government. Left, right, center, doesn't matter. We're there to be a check. And the idea that this is somehow between us and the president is not helpful to advance the debate I want to talk about, which is the importance of having a powerful media that can be a check on government. One of the things I've said in many places is I grew up here, and I grew up in a very patriotic, conservative place, and I'm thankful for that. My mother was a World War II veteran. My father was a World War II veteran. But when you grew up in Illinois in the 60s and 70s, you knew one thing about politics and government, and that is the governor goes to jail. Governor Kerner went to jail. Governor Walker went to jail. When the Secretary of State died, there were shoeboxes full of money.
Unfortunately, that trend has still continued well past the 60s and 70s.
And that's exactly why. It's exactly why you need a press that's going to serve as a check on that. That's what I think is important. So I don't see belief in freedom of the press as a liberal value. I see it as an American value. It's actually an international value, and people get mad at me when I say it's an American value. But here's, you know, for me, it's fine to hate the press. It is fine to criticize the press. And everybody should be looking at the facts and saying, is that right? It's another thing to just say, don't pay any attention to them, disregard them, because that is not the pursuit of the truth. That's just the opposite. That is an invitation to label and disregard, not to read and discern.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with David McCraw, New York Times Deputy General Counsel. I want to find out a little bit more about how he ended up from Monticello to being in the New York Times, teaching at Harvard. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and my guest is David McCraw. He's the Vice President and Deputy General Counsel at The New York Times, and his new book is just out. It's called Truth in Our Times, Inside the Fight for Press Freedom in an Age of Alternative Facts. David is in town. He's in studio with me here in Urbana. He is a native of Central Illinois. He's from Monticello. He's a U of I grad, among other things. David, how did you, so I wonder how you end up from, there's clearly a path from Monticello to journalism to then becoming a lawyer and the New York Times. You wrote in the book that you grew up reading the newspaper in Decatur.
I did. No, in fairness, the News Gazette was also a big part of my growing up as well. But the Decatur Herald came in the morning. My father, who was worked at the bank in Monticello, would always get up and have coffee and read the Decatur Herald. And I soon was drinking coffee at 5 years old. That didn't last very long. But reading the newspaper with him, which did last a long time.
And that was what sparked your love of journalism. So why you decided to study journalism when you came to the University of Illinois?
Well, you know, let's not skip over. I was the founding editor of The Scribe at Monticello High School. I was part of the first class at MHS where journalism was offered as one of the English electives. And that was a great experience and a great introduction to both the challenges and the opportunities of journalism. But yeah, so I came to Illinois and was a journalism major here.
And so I wonder if you can remind me of the era of this. I mean, if we're thinking about the 70s and the Pentagon Papers and Watergate and how much that inspired, you know, there's a whole conversation about how there's a whole new generation of journalists that are being inspired by current times.
That's right.
You were part of this, a group that was inspired by, I imagine, Watergate and Nixon and all of these.
Yeah. So I graduated from Illinois in 1976, but as a high school student, I actually came over here. I think I snuck in, but
to Urbana,
into the journalism school to go to see a lecture by Peter Arnett, who was a great AP war correspondent covering the Vietnam War. And I'm sure it was probably open to the public, but I thought I was getting away with something. And it was so inspiring. But that was part of, I think, my generation of journalists and people who work in around journalism like myself, which was that it was Watergate. It was the coverage of the civil rights movement. It was the coverage of the Vietnam War. Nobody in this country had to be reminded that we were lucky to be a country that had a free press.
So we talked about you graduating, working in journalism. When did you make the shift to thinking about going into law?
As I tell the students in my law school classes, I was sent to law school. They don't have that excuse. They want to be here, so they have to suffer the consequences of having me as their professor. I was teaching journalism at a small college in Poughkeepsie, New York, Marist College, and loved it. But I'd arrived at the point in my life where I didn't really have a future in higher education without an advanced degree. And the academic vice president said, why don't you go get your law degree, because that would help our program. I took a year off to do the first year of law school, loved it. It was at a time in my life when I was really open to a new challenge. And I went back to Marist and said, I think I want to pursue this as a career. They were completely supportive.
There's something that you wrote about in the book, and you talked about how at one point in time, trying to understand a little bit of looking at support for President Trump among more rural voters or obviously more conservative places, which is when we think about kind of the land outside of Chicago, it definitely describes a lot of Illinois. You at one point described, you said that, you know, there were good people who supported President Trump. And then there was a kind of a little bit. I wonder if you can describe a little bit of how people responded when you wrote that.
Yeah, I was a little taken aback because there was such polarization in the country. There were people who had demonized not only President Trump, but his supporters. And I thought that was completely unfair. And I thought it was an attack on what makes us Americans, which is that we have a whole lot of different beliefs and we're all here together and we need to figure out how to do that. I think it came as a shock to people because they had seen my letter, which I had written in my role as defending the New York Times, normal course of events. They saw as sort of being part of the Trump resistance, and I just didn't want to be framed in quite that way. And I hope that in part, writing the book and talking about these issues is that people don't see it as a screed against Trump. That was not my point. I hope they see it as a celebration of the First Amendment and of a free press. Somebody reviewing the book for the New York Times, you know, talked about it as a love letter to the First Amendment. I'm going to own that.
When you think about, though, the really deep divisions that we have right now, and I do think we've sort of, and I think obviously the 2016 election really sort of laid bare, I think, a very clear division or divide between the coasts and this country. And I think oftentimes the New York Times is kind of seen as and been accused of, sometimes rightly so, I will say, of being sort of like the New York coastal elite and not really and being out of touch with people here. How do you defend that to folks in your hometown?
I was having this conversation the other night in a public forum I did with the executive editor of the New York Times, Dean Baquet. And I think we both agree that the election of Donald Trump was a bit of a reset moment for the New York Times to take some hard look at those kind of criticisms that you just articulated. And he's from New Orleans. I'm from Monticello. And both of us, I think, had the sense that the Times was at times tone deaf to the rest of America. It's not a good place to be, both journalistically and financially. You want to be able to be reached, people across a broad spectrum. And right after, as I talk about in the book, right after the election, there's a town meeting at the New York Times where reporters and others can air their views to the executive editor. And some people were concerned that the paper had normalized Donald Trump, whatever that meant to them, but the paper wasn't critical enough of Trump. Somebody else stood up and said, "I'm from Ohio, and we didn't really understand America, the rest of America." And Dean said something very wise that day, which was, "We do not want to be seen as the lapdog of any political party, because when they're in office, we're going to be in the worst possible shape to do what we need to do, which is to be a watchdog, not a lapdog."
And so when you think about that and we think about the whole idea of the First Amendment, I do want to come back to what you said before the break and what you write about in the book, which is that we can have laws that protect free speech. We can have laws that protect a free press. But we don't really have laws when it comes to, for example, fake news. And I don't know if that's something that can be, if we can, it's not legislate, but if we can create laws around fake news and also then sort of the broader issue of trust. We can have all the laws we want, but if people don't really trust what we do, does it even matter?
That's right. That's right. As I say in the book, the laws can create a free press, but it can't create a free press that matters. And the great thing about the American scheme, about the very foundation of democracy, is that the founding fathers and those who came after did not really think that we should have a ministry of truth, that the government should be telling us what's true. The great thing about that is we have the opportunity to be free thinkers and get it whatever information we want to make decisions in our lives. But the downside of that is we get fake news. And it is up to us as citizens to be the remedy. That's not a really satisfying answer because it's not easy. It's not simple. It's not going to be short term. Right after the book came out, I received an email from a reader. And my initial instinct when I read the first line was, oh, my gosh, this is going to be one of those people who's going to be hating on me. Because it begins, why did you write this book? And so it was so discouraging to read that first line. I actually put it away, came back to it the next day when I had a little more fortitude. I went on and read it, and she was making an incredible sense. And she said, why did you write this book? You should be writing for young adults, because that's when we need to be talking to people about media literacy, about truth, about how do you fact check, about where you go to get opinions that are worth listening to and thinking about. And she's exactly right.
I actually think in some ways, though, our youngest citizens are better at discerning this in a way because it's they're digital natives. I worry more about people my age and older. I worry about people who are using digital media and on sites like Facebook and not being able to distinguish between what's real and fake.
Yeah, and the surveys tend to the research tends to support that view. Obviously, this is a very complicated topic, and if you look at the research on fake news, you find out that people who are heavy readers of fake news are also heavy readers of the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and other mainstream publications. And you can have a theory about why that is. They're going over to see what lies we're telling, or they're going over there to see what lies they've just read.
Or they're just in a news environment, so they're getting all kinds
right,
of news.
So they want to read. But you're absolutely right. And when I speak on college campuses, I make exactly that point, which I say, look, if you are old enough to have a child in this college, you are more of a problem than that child when it comes to fake news, because you don't have the tools naturally to sift out what you're reading before you decide to send it to everybody in your friends' network.
So getting back to the whole idea of this book as a love letter to the First Amendment, and thinking about the fact that even though we continue to have laws in this country that do support a free press, I wonder what you would say to people who don't think it's important, because I do think there, what we've been talking about is maybe not a fundamental shift, but clearly a shift in thinking in this country to maybe not valuing as much the work journalists do. And it's very nuanced, right?
That's right.
Like when you look at the Pew research that came out recently, there's trust in local news is very high. Regardless, you know, people trust their local news or outlets. Maybe that's a little bit different. I think the whole term, the media, I hate because I don't really know what that means anyway. But all of that aside, the whole idea of whether or not people are shifting or don't care enough about the First Amendment, what would you say to them?
One of the things I say is reflect on yourself.
Or they think we're too political, right?
Right.
They think
right.
We have a bias. I work for public radio, so I must hate President Trump.
Right, right. And to some extent, all of us who work in media have to own that we created some of the problem. I think we were, for many years of our existence, financially capable of being disregarding of our audiences. We'll tell you what you need to know. We don't really, if you want to write a letter to the editor, we'll accept it. We don't really need to know much more about you. That's changed. I think we're much more attuned to understanding and trying to understand the lives of our readers and being less arrogant at times. I think we were guilty of that. But one of the things that I try to get people to do is reflect on their own behavior. The example I use in the book is that Donald Trump saying fake news, New York Times is fake news, failing New York Times, fake news and all that. And then there's this tweet, this incredible tweet about a year and a half ago saying, read this story in the New York Times, because the New York Times is reporting that the CIA was trying to get dirt on me. Suddenly it was not fake news. It was suddenly Matt Rosenberg's story was the truth. And I use that not to show hypocrisy, but to show that's how we all are. You know, we're supposed to say bad things about our schools, about our workplaces. You know, you hate your boss. That's just part of the American cliche. And hating the media is part of that. But reflect on your own behavior, how much you get that is of value and how much you organize your life around what you read. So that becomes the first part of the message. The second part of the message is the difference between criticizing a particular story, saying, you know, that language, it seemed like it went too far one way or the other politically, or why didn't you cover that story? Those things are totally legitimate. What's not legitimate is to simply dismiss wholesale. It's a little bit like anybody who has a child. You say, boy, misbehaved today. I'm going to do something about that. I'm not going to say, okay, that's it. I'm putting the kid in the orphanage. Same thing with the free press. You know, criticize the story, ask hard questions, but understand that the value of the institution.
David McCraw is a vice president and deputy general counsel at the New York Times, and his new book is called Truth in Our Times, Inside the Fight for Press Freedom in an Age of Alternative Facts. David, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It was really great to be talking to Central Illinois directly.
That does it for us today. Our Twitter handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. On Facebook, if you search for the 21st to like us, it's another way to comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, just head to our website, 21stshow.org. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.